You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The heart of where innovation, money, and power collide in Silicon Valley and beyond. This is Bloomberg Technology with Caroline Hyde and Ed Ludlow.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up, semiconductor slide. That's on reports that China has told telecom carriers to drop foreign chips. We'll bring you the details.
Plus, Apple plans to overhaul its entire line of Mac computers to add an AI-focused in-house processor. We'll break down our exclusive Bloomberg reporting.
And Cathy Wood buys into ChatGPT boom with a stake in OpenAI. We'll discuss that and so much more throughout the hour. But first, let's get over to these publicly traded markets from a macro context. This is one where we're seeing a search for safety today. There is worries regarding Iran, Israel. We're seeing geopolitical risks heightened and maybe just the squaring away of certain, you know, volatility that we've seen throughout the week when it comes to concerns about CPI, PPI as we move towards the weekend. We're currently seeing, for once, equities actually moving at the opposite way of a bond market. Even though the bond market has been selling off and equities have still managed to ride higher, today it's the opposite. We're actually seeing bond markets move higher. We're seeing money move into the havens that are the 10-year yield off by also 8-9 basis points. So we're seeing money move there, money move into the Bloomberg Dollar Index. In fact, the highest level that since we've seen in 2024, Ed, we're up another 0.7%. But money coming out of equities as we worry about geopolitical tensions. Pensions were off by 1.4% on the Nasdaq, and of course that key chip story that we'll be digging into in a moment. Move on, have a little look at what's happening in another key risk asset, and actually surprisingly flat for Bitcoin overall over the course of a week. Now, the volatility has been there to see on a day-to-day basis, and we rode higher at the start, but we've just come off of some of those highs. Of course, a dollar strength is going to mean a bit of a Bitcoin weakness. But Ed, what are you watching?
We have a lot of technology stories to bring you this Friday. Apple is an interesting one, up 0.7% after a 4% jump Thursday, which I think was the biggest jump since May of last year. Bloomberg's Mark Gurman is reporting a complete overhaul of the Mac line, and we'll talk to Mark a little bit later in the program. Alphabet, parent of Google, down a percentage point. It's giving us a little bit back after hitting the $2 trillion market cap mark Thursday. Recently, a lot more optimism that Google's starting to get it right on AI. They'll actually have products, particularly in the enterprise or commercial use case, but pulling back a little bit this Friday after a key milestone. We're keeping our eyes on the banks. Bank earnings kind of kick us off for earnings overall. You can see it's kind of mixed fortunes, all of these three names moving to the downside. Going into it for us on Bloomberg Technology, AI, what's happening with AI and banks was a big theme, but they all have their own individual stories. I'm not going to tell you the story. Bloomberg's Shanali Basak, the correct person to bring us the bank's wrap, joins us on set in New York, and she brings you this story. Shanali, three big names, both moving lower, all moving lower.
Yeah, all moving lower, and remember, that is a little bit of a reversal. Citigroup had beat profit estimates here, and we did see an earlier gain. Remember, the market is lower on the day, but some of the declines you're seeing are quite stark. JP Morgan, for example, intraday is having its worst day since March of 2023, when we know times were very different. Remember, Ed, we have JP Morgan coming off six consecutive years of record revenue. So the big question is, when analysts had expected them to raise the bar on net interest income, are they just being conservative when they have not done so? Or are we seeing a consumer that is starting to, if not tap out, start to slow down a little bit in the way that they are starting to borrow and spend on those credit card businesses in particular? Now, some positive news for anyone watching Bloomberg Technology in particular is you do see an uptick here you're in those underwriting businesses, IPOs are back, baby, and you are seeing it in the number of big banks. And certainly, you don't see the advisory fees jumping back just as strong yet, but they're pretty optimistic over there at JP Morgan on what things are starting to look like in investment banking.
And you didn't even mention AI. Shanali Basak, we thank you so much for bringing us the latest on an earnings context. And of course, we brace ourselves for the technology earnings to start coming thick and fast at the end of next week. But for now, we're focused in on basically all of the chip sector under pressure. We shine a light on Intel off by 3.4%. AMD, one of your worst performers, off by almost 4%. But in fact, every single member of the semiconductor index, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, is in the red. Onsemi off by more than 4%. But really, this is as we see the reporting coming from the Wall Street Journal at the moment, Ed. Beijing ordering telecom carriers, China Mobile and the likes to say no to foreign chips in their core networks by 2027. This is really notable, but perhaps unsurprising.
Yeah, it is it's another development in China's effort to onshore their own semiconductor industry, right? So the journal, one key part of their report is that actually the Ministry for Industry and Information Technology has given a timeline, call it a timeline or a deadline, for not just China Mobile, but China Unicom and China Telecom Corp to swap out foreign chips, those being US chip makers. AMD, Intel get 25% revenue historically from China on the more commercial use case for chips, and put in a domestic one. The question really is, is there a domestic supply chain ready to support that?
By 2027, they often might well hope so. And it's interesting, Ed, that almost front-running this was a great piece out of Bloomberg Intelligence just saying that Chinese export curbs are actually more of a risk than U.S. export curbs at the moment. This is a tit-for-tat that you and I have been reporting on since we first got together back in 2022 of this technology show, and really thinking about how U.S. is trying to restrain some of its own technology going into China. Well, unsurprisingly, China's going to be doing the same in reverse, but this time, actually, BI saying China's export restrictions are going to be key policy risk to some of the U.S. chip manufacturers that have, in recent years, built up their overall supply chain dependency on China. So I think that's a really another interesting shoe to drop at the moment, whether it's export restrictions or whether it's at the moment import restrictions coming from China of US tech.
I think we should just get to someone who's got skin in the game. Joining us now is Alison Porter, portfolio manager on the Global Technology Leaders and Sustainable Future Technology Funds at Janus Henderson. And I think I'm right in saying if we just pick out AMD as an example, it's one name that you have exposure to or that you hold. You know, the journal is reporting one specific industry case of a much broader thing where China wants its domestic entities to use domestic chips. Your response to that?
Well, you know, I would put a little bit of this into context. China, top-down, urging foreign chips and telcos, we don't see it as being, you know, a huge change, because essentially that's a market that has been dominated by Huawei, and the use of those and the use of in-house chips has been around for a number of years now, since chip companies were banned from supporting Huawei's 5G rollout. And really, in terms of China telco 5G spend, that actually peaked some time ago. And other areas like FPGAs, you know, they've had a significant inventory correction. And for, you know, China, who may want to replace US chips, but again, you know, actually using 7-nanometer chips domestically, they don't have that supply yet. So I think for them to get to 5-nanometer or 3-nanometer, you're going to need those for 6G deployment, which will ultimately need US chips by that time period. So, you know, we think this is ongoing wrangling, but in terms of the end markets, it's not hugely significant for the areas that we're focused on.
Let's go to where your focus there for, Alison, because all of this comes in a current context of a fret over supply. We are all envisioning a whole new world in which we're going to be living in thanks to generative artificial intelligence, but we need the chips, we need the supply chain, we need to be building these things, we need the energy. Alison, what chip names are going to be doing well in spite of geopolitical headwinds?
Well, when I started looking at technology stocks back in 1996, I think about over a third of chip supply in the was actually built in the US, over 30%. And wind forward to the pandemic, and that was down to 12%. So we see this ongoing focus of deglobalization that is part of national security. It's part of national interest for AI. It's also part of the overall focus on improving supply chain standards, ESG standards throughout the technology supply chain. And therefore, we think that actually manufacturing is becoming a more competitive advantage, more difficult to replicate. Many contract manufacturers, for example, Jabil, Flextronic, the ability to be able to manufacture at scale. These companies have much lower margins, and traditionally that could be easily moved around from competitors, but that's now becoming much more difficult at scale for many of the large OEMs to actually move the manufacturing capacity around. Yeah. So we think that's one way that we see deglobalization, the CHIPS Act, actually play into where companies manufacture.
As a global technology leaders and sustainable future tech fund, then, do you worry that you're going to have to be sacrificing margin on some of the companies that you're investing in globally because they're having to, you know, manufacture in more expensive places to secure supply chain? Or can you start to play out, well, opportunities more globally that are being overlooked as we've all just focused in on a so-called Magnificent Seven?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's you know, a significant focus on margins and efficiency. You know, the Morgan Stanley Technology Conference in March showed that, where, you know, the two most named terms from all of the presentations at that conference weren't AI, it wasn't CHIPS Act, it was in fact margins and efficiency. And you see, you know, I think that's one of the really interesting aspects of where we are just now, because we have a major new technology wave, but that's also hitting at a time when, you know, we have this rising cost of capital and companies are really focused on efficiencies and improving margins. And that creates really interesting opportunities for investors. And it's a real stock picker's market. So it's not easy to generalise on subsectors. It's very much about, you know, active management, which is quite typical when we hit these technology inflection points.
In this stock picker's market, should you pick Apple? Apple is becoming increasingly attractive, it seems, to you guys. 12-month forward PE of 25 times. It had been downtrodden. Now is it a good name?
We own Apple within our portfolio, but it's not been one of our largest holdings for quite some time. Apple's a tremendous company. It led technology in each of the last three waves, you know, through the PC wave, the mobile internet. They were all really started by product catalysts from Apple. This AI wave was started by the product catalysts of Microsoft on ChatGPT and OpenAI, and also NVIDIA on silicon. And Apple's role in AI has yet to be defined, and we're sure that over the longer term they will continue to innovate, but right now they're not one of the early drivers of this generative AI wave.
Alison Porter, just a joy to have you on. Thank you, Janice Henderson, talking us through the winners and the losers you're looking at in the moment. And look, we were just finishing there on Apple and its focus, or lack thereof, on AI. Let's just talk about Apple overhauling, therefore, its entire Mac line with in-house processors that, guess what, focus on artificial intelligence. We're going to bring you the details next. This is Bloomberg Technology. Apple, it's looking to boost some lagging computer sales with an overhaul of its entire Mac line, planning to unveil an AI-focused M4 processor. Apple is aiming to release the updated computers beginning actually late this year, extending into early next year. Joining us now with the scoop, of course, Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. And Mark, this is a very quick upgrade, basically. The cycle is so short.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me. I mean, Apple Silicon started off on about a 1.5-year, 1.5-year upgrade cycle, and they've accelerated that. The M3 chips came a little sooner than anticipated in October of 2023, so just about 6 months ago. Now, the M4 chips are going to be coming even sooner than that, coming about 1 year after the M3 processors. So they're planning new iMacs, Mac Minis, low-end MacBook Pros, high-end Mac Pros, like you said, for release between the end of 24 and early 25. 2025. So this is an accelerated timeline. And it's interesting because this is now matching the timeline of processor upgrades that you see on the iPhone and that you once saw on the iPad, but no longer. And this is pretty significant. In-house silicon is becoming an even more important part of the company's story. There are other companies that are so hyper-focused on the cloud and such. Apple's still focused on in-device chips.
I think that's where we should focus, Mark. Our last guest, Allison Porter at Janus, is an Apple shareholder. And what she just told us is that, to her mind, Apple's role in AI has yet to be defined. But I look at where the stock closed Thursday after you published your report, and again, the momentum today. And I think the market sees an AI story. What are you hearing internally at Apple about this side of it?
The AI story at Apple exists, and it's almost the complete opposite of what you're seeing from other companies. There's so much hype around NVIDIA because of their cloud infrastructure that powers artificial intelligence. There's ChatGPT and Gemini. Those are all cloud products. Apple's LLM is an on-device approach, meaning it runs entirely on the device, which makes it more privacy-centric, but also, in some cases, it can perform actions far quickly. There's no lag time because it's on the devices themselves. And these new AI chips, or the upgraded AI components that you're seeing on the M4 starting later this year, as well as the A18 Pro chip that you'll see in the iPhone 16 Pro and Pro Max later this year, upgraded neural engines, improved processing, improved microphones to really optimize artificial intelligence in Siri on a device. Now, we should note that Apple has been shipping neural engines, those AI blocks inside of their chips, for several years now, but this is going to be dubbed the biggest upgrade to the neural engine since that component was first released several years ago.
Bloomberg's Mark Gurman, brilliant. Thank you. Now, coming up on the show, DocuSign unveiling a new platform and an expansion of his company strategy. We're going to discuss that with the CEO, Allan Thygesen. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Talking Tech, and in the news, Tokyo-based startup Sakana AI is capitalizing on surging interest from Japanese firms. Founded by ex-Google researchers, Sakana won government supercomputer grants and partnerships with blue-chip companies. This is in an effort to build out Japan's AI ecosystem. Sakana uses small data sets to train low-cost Gen AI models that could be used to ramp up a company's AI capabilities. Plus, Samsung is set to unveil a $44 billion push into U.S. chip making as soon as next week. According to sources, they're going to outline a project in Taylor, Texas, after securing more than $6 billion from government grants. The award marks the latest push from the Biden administration to revitalize chip making in the United States. And the House is set to try again on advancing the reauthorization of a U.S. spy bill. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act failed to reach the floor on Wednesday over GOP concerns terms of privacy and Section 702. That provision allows the surveillance of foreign targets and the potential to warrantlessly survey Americans in contact with them. The bill underwent a revision to a two-year period from five in an attempt to swing its Republican critics. Caroline.
Let's move away from politics to product announcements now. DocuSign Holdings had its just annual Momentum User Conference this week, and it set us up with some new products that include an intelligent agreement management platform. Let's dig into exactly what that is. DocuSign CEO Alan Tigerson, I'm pleased to welcome you. Thanks for joining. So a SaaS category.
Yes.
How is this different from what people already experience?
Well, so the people know us mostly for e-signature, and that will continue. But if you think about agreements, they go through an entire journey. And there is pain and inefficiency at every point in that journey. If you think about salespeople from when they maybe reach agreement in principle to when they can finally sign an agreement, or a purchasing manager who's trying to figure out whether their vendors are living up to their obligations, or a recruiter trying to close a candidate, those are all at their core agreement problems. And we are delivering a suite to help companies solve their entire range of agreement problems.
And so I'm a company, I have suddenly a central depository, I know exactly where all of my legal agreements are, and I can use generative AI to summarize them to ensure that I'm learning the most, ensure that they're basically following a theme all in line and purpose. Why is this different from what perhaps when you unveil it in late May, what Box could suddenly bring us with their central repository system and suddenly bring in Gen AI?
Yes, well, there are lots of folks who do storage and more generally manage documents. But agreements are very, very unique. They have a particular structure. There's a tremendous amount of data in them, and you need to understand the context. And so we are, I think, experts at that. The largest player is solely focused on agreements and have a tremendous amount of domain knowledge and understanding of the intricacy of agreements. And there's also workflow associated with agreements, and we're bringing out tools to help companies deliver those in a much more delightful and digitally native way.
Alan, good morning. It's Ed in San Francisco. In the history of technology, there are companies that completely reinvent themselves, right? Take BlackBerry as an example. Mm-hmm. It used to make smartphones. It now largely makes automotive software. The e-signature product is still everything for you guys. But I wonder if you are trying to tell your investors, your users, your audience that you see a future for DocuSign where it's something different beyond e-signature, where the main business is not e-signature.
Well, certainly beyond e-signature, but e-signature will be critical to DocuSign for years to come. It's such a valuable product, solves such a unique pain point very well. And after all, the signature moment is a pivotal, perhaps the highest value moment in that agreement journey. What we're doing here is we are expanding and providing a full suite of offerings related to every step in the agreement journey. No one has done that before. I think we're the best position to do it. We have the trust, we have the customer reach and the expertise, and we're benefiting from recent developments in AI. And so we're bringing all that to the table, and I think now is our moment.
Alan, you've talked a lot about DocuSign being in transition. In considering where you are in that transition, give yourself a scorecard, A, B, C, on your performance and where you've been in delivering that.
Well, I like to measure outcomes, so I certainly wouldn't give myself an A yet. I think we are making really good progress. I'd give it a B. We have done, I think, an excellent job revitalizing the innovation engine, now bringing out a really, really robust suite of products informed by years of customer feedback and tremendous engagement from beta customers. And now it's time to take that to market and roll it out across all of the customer segments and geographies and industries that DocuSign serves. And that will be a multi-year journey. So certainly the job's not done yet, but this is a major milestone for us, and we're very excited about what the future holds.
It comes to bear end of May. Come and tell us how it all goes. Alan Tigerson, it's so great to have some time with you. Thank you for stopping by the studio. DocuSign CEO.
Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. Ed Ludlow here in San Francisco.
Caroline Hyde in New York. A quick check on these markets as we head towards the weekend, and some caution in those markets. Risk aversion as we worry about geopolitical risks. Israel, Iran, front of mind for many. We're seeing tech stocks, all the benchmarks and equities actually down amid some of that, taking risk on the table as money goes into the bond market, into the US dollar, for example, off by some 7 basis points. But tech also getting dragged down by chips. I'll speak to that in a moment. Looking at Bitcoin, another key risk asset, just lower as the dollar goes higher on some remember this risk aversion, we're off by more than a percentage point, but basically flat over the last five trading days. Move on, have a little look at what's happening on the individual movers, because for once, actually, Apple is on the higher side. We're still 176 there or thereabouts, but this, as we understand, thanks to Mark Gurman, that they are looking to overhaul the processes within some of their Mac lineup, M4 coming to the fore, and indeed AI front and center on your computer. We're up by 0.7%. Stocks, though, chip stocks. In fact, every single member of this particular index is in the red today. Why? Wall Street Journal reporting that China is now looking to fight back when it comes to that tit-for-tat and chip access. And they're saying to their Chinese telecom giants, don't have foreign-made chips in you by 2027 into your overall networks. That's sending AMD, Intel in particular, to the downside. This one's interesting. It's basically been a meme stock of choice of late. Destiny Tech 100, DXYZ. It's a closed-end fund that gets you access to privately held companies. If you want to gain access to the likes of, well, Plaid, or whether it's Stripe, whether it's OpenAI, whether it's SpaceX, well, this has been a way of doing it. But it's made itself a meme frenzy. Retail investors piling in. 1,000% increase at 1% at point, having just listed in the last month or so. We're down by 22%. But Ed, it's not the only investment vehicle doing this.
Yeah, hold that thought on Destiny Tech 100. We will come back to it. Cathie Wood's ARK Investment Management has also announced that it holds a stake in OpenAI through its venture fund in a bet that the AI industry will remake the tech landscape. Joining us now is Brett Winton, who is ARK chief futurist, also a member of the investment committee. And Brett, you and I spoke last night. You got access to OpenAI, which is a private company with a closed profit structure through a special purpose vehicle, SPV. But it's part of a broader thesis around foundation models. Give me the short version of the thesis.
Sure. AI software is going to revolutionize knowledge work, $13 trillion is going to be spent on AI software, and $3 trillion of that is going to flow into kind of what we think of as foundation models. So OpenAI and Anthropic are the two most prominent examples with the best models in the marketplace, both of which are in the venture fund. And $3 trillion translates into an expectation for around $16 trillion in market cap attributable to those foundation models. So to give you context, the global equity market is a little more than $100 trillion as of the end of last year.
Right.
And so $16 trillion, you know, it's a big chunk, almost sector-sized in terms of our expectations for enterprise value footprint.
ARK Venture Fund is an interval fund which is made of 80% private companies, 20% public. You can get access not just only to OpenAI, but SpaceX and Anthropic. Why is it different or not the same as the Destiny Tech 100 that Caroline was just explaining at the start of the segment?
Because our interval fund is continuously offered, price that you pay when you buy it is reflective of the value of the underlying securities in it. So if you buy $100 of an interval fund, you get $100 of net asset value. The Destiny Fund has a net asset value of less than $5, and they don't issue additional shares even if there's excess demand. So if you buy the Destiny Fund at $50, you're paying, you know, $50 for $5 worth of exposure. Like, that fund, roughly a little more than a third is SpaceX, but buy $100 of that versus $100 of our venture fund, you actually end up with more exposure to SpaceX in our venture fund, which is just 4.4% or roughly 4% of the venture fund. So it's really actually, I understand people want to get access to innovation. I think that's absolutely the right thing to do. And you need to be careful about how you get access to innovation. You should do so in a way where you're not buying, you know, 10 cents worth of stuff for a dollar worth of spending.
So it's kind of down to structure and huge premium that you're currently seeing on DXYZ. Do you also think it's something to do with the narrative? This blew up on Reddit and other like-minded sort of retail-focused areas. Do you think that your own ARK Venture Investment Fund will do the same?
I mean, I think that you know, I think that people are excited about innovation and they're looking for ways to access it. And this happened to kind of flash across social media channels in a way that inspired them to be like, oh, yes, I want access to that company. And conceptually, there are, and actually practically, there are much, much more efficient and better ways to express that point of view. I think you can't, like, you can't tell beforehand what's going to, you know, take off on Reddit, but you can tell when something is going to end in tears for people. And so when you're buying 10 cents for a dollar, you end up at the end of the day with something close to 10 cents, even if it doesn't trade that. Like, there's all kinds of ways in which that premium should diminish over time. And so I would advise you to pay a dollar and get a dollar's worth of stuff.
Brett, well said. $16 trillion by 2030. That's an arresting figure when you think of the overall market valuation for these foundational models. Do you wish you could access more OpenAI and ultimately Anthropic as well when you're thinking of the rest that makes up the fund, when I'm looking at SpaceX, but Epic Games as well, Freenome Holdings, Relation Therapeutics? How much do you want foundational models, the AI bet, to take up of this fund?
Well, the way we think about it is there are five major technology platforms entering the marketplace, and each has the potential for amazing compounding returns. And you're better off constructing a portfolio that has, yes, AI exposure, and autonomous mobility exposure, and multi-omics exposure, because those exposures could independently fail. Like, are we 100% right on AI? I think it's going to be amazing, an amazing revolution. But if that that drags out to the right, it's unlikely that cryptocurrencies also will drag out to the right. So by exposing yourself to a number of innovation platforms, you actually end up with a more efficient exposure to innovation as a whole that delivers better returns.
Brett, last night, Bloomberg reported that xAI, Musk's AI company, is trying to raise between $3 and $4 billion at around an $18 billion valuation, according to, frankly, our sources, but also a copy of the prospectus. Will ARK, through the venture fund, try and add xAI, given your coverage of SpaceX and Tesla already?
I can't comment on future, like, decisions. I will say that actually, ownership in X confers a 25% pro rata ownership in xAI. I think that the company's future is actually closely intermingled. xAI's competitive advantage is it has real-time access to everything that happens on X, which is where all news effectively breaks. And in a world in which historical data is commoditized, which is part of what AI models are going to do, real-time data becomes more valuable and dear. And so having a real-time decision engine sitting at the front end of X, I think, is a really interesting and compelling value proposition for xAI.
Brett, as you know, last night I learned a lot about the venture fund, the mechanics of how it works. It's actually, I told you, very confusing. If you're a retail investor, you can access through Fidelity, Titan, and I'm blanking, there's a third one.
SoFi.
But my point, SoFi. Give me a sense of how your announcement that you've built a pretty small stake in OpenAI has moved the needle for that fund. Overnight this morning, have you seen new customers and investment try to rush in because they now know that they can have some exposure there?
I mean, the honest answer is I don't know, because we don't get flows with, you know, that high a degree of frequency. And the decision to invest in these companies is not a decision based upon how it's going to attract attention. It's because we underwrite the positions and we think they deliver, you know, outsized returns, even relative to public market exposure. So one of the benefits of this fund is, you know, we can look at, hey, this is an interesting company, and there's a comparable public company that that this is actually cheaper than. And so I think that the potential for returns across all of these technology platforms is really profound. And we want every investor, not just accredited investors, to be able to have access to those returns.
Brett, going back to the OpenAI thesis as one of the winners of the $6 trillion market, what are the limitations of it going up and to the right? because there are concerns about ultimately supply chain, this coalition that's being built because we're worried about energy, not only just the amount of chips that are necessary that are going to be building this future of generative AI, but also it's a competitive space right now. And also there's a weird corporate governance structure that goes on over at OpenAI. What are the risks for you on that name?
Sure. I mean, there are corporate governance structures risks, and you know, you can underwrite those. So we've gone through and assessed them, but there is a degree of uncertainty there. There are regulatory risks across all of technology exposures. I think that we look back to even like nuclear power is an amazing technology that was effectively derailed because of kind of the regulatory burdens put upon it back in the 1970s. And there's the potential that that could happen with AI as well, where we're worried about something, and so we deny ourselves all the benefits of it, but still take on all of the risks. And we think that there's a room for commercial models like OpenAI and Anthropics and open source models like what Meta is developing. I think that the market will have a handful of solutions, any one of which could be profoundly valuable. And when you have this much market opportunity ahead of you, you know, you go for that asymmetric return where kind of like the one or two winners here are going to be profoundly valuable. And so we think an exposure is appropriate and actually necessary.
Brett Winton of ARK Venture Investment, or ARK Investment Management. It's great to have you on the program. Thank you very much for your time. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is Bloomberg Technology.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
New York-based Alicorp. It's just announced it's raised $250 million in taking on external investors for the first time. The person behind Alicorp is known as the godfather of VC here in New York, Kevin Ryan, founder, CEO of that business. We welcome him to VC Spotlight. And before, you spent a lot of time and focus on small-sized businesses, investing your own money, because you had a huge exit back in the day, having, of course, been the CEO, co-founder of DoubleClick, sold it to Google. Now, what is the reason you're bringing on external LPs?
Yeah, it's more thinking long-term. You know, I'm still a very important LP in this fund, but when I think over the next 20, 25 years, I think Alicorp will be a firm that is here, that is very present, that is going to be one of the leading firms. And to do that, you want to have sustainable source of money for the next seven funds. And so this is the beginning step for that.
Beginning step in taking bets on beginning businesses, seeds and Series A?
Yeah, it's not changing what we're doing yet. We do two things. We start companies from scratch. So I start 6 to 8 companies a year, and then we invest invest in probably 15 to 20. So we have a portfolio of over 100 companies, and I have a 24-person team. And so we've been doing that. We're going to continue to do that. And we're still seeing, you know, incredible opportunities out there.
Many would know you for helping seed MongoDB, yep. which, of course, big exit, traded here in New York. But is that still the kind of company you want to be getting into? We're all talking about generative AI at the moment, but you're also focused on healthcare. Tell us the theses that you want to get
into. Yeah, we have a couple different industry groups that we're focused on. So AI is definitely an important thing. I just started a company with some people on my team called Radical that is a company focused on AI for materials science. It's a very specific, very technical area and an enormous, enormous area. So that's a fundamental trend. Last year, we started a company in assisted fertility. You and I both know that 20 years ago, none of our friends were having their eggs frozen or IVF. That's growing. It will continue to grow for the next 10 years. We have a big healthcare portfolio, so present in a lot of different areas, mental health areas in particular, psychedelics in particular. Started one company that's raised over $50 million already, and I'm looking to start another company in that space. So the point is there are pockets and things to be done. Technology is continuing to change the world and make it a better place, and we just want to think of these ideas or recognize them and help build these companies.
Kevin, you called them pockets, but I kind of recognize outliers of activity. You know, you see a lot of rounds being done in AI. Yeah. Actually, I'm starting to see some in industrial technology. Mm-hmm. But I guess the commonality of the last 12 months is that at each round, the check size is getting bigger.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you needed that $250 million from outside investors because you got to write bigger checks.
No, our check size isn't really changing that much. You know, I had invested over $250 million in the last several years. So this is a continuation of that. Some of the companies like Mongo, you know, we started that 15 years ago with $1 million. Dwight Merriman and I put that money in. But we raised $400 million as a private company and then spent another $600 million as a public company to get to break even. So large companies do take a lot of capital. We're not going to provide all of it. Early stage investors are taking the most risk and getting the most return by coming up with that idea in the very beginning. But luckily, there are lots of late stage funds that step in to help fund these.
Were you able to be selective with LPs, or were these LPs that were kind of coming to you and saying, I want some exposure to what's happening in AI right now. Can you offer that to me?
Yeah, we were fortunate. We were able to be pretty selective. We really just went out to family offices. It's a pretty small list of people. We wanted families that would add value. So these are all people that had come from the healthcare industry, the technology industry, something else. We can call on them if we want to do some due diligence. So we're pretty happy with that list of investors. We didn't go very widely. There aren't large institutions. We don't have pension funds because at least at this point, they would add less value than some of the family offices.
I started this conversation by calling you the godfather of NYC tech. And it is because NYC tech is now getting really serious.
Yeah.
People do feel that there's an about change. And you've been there for a long time saying there are businesses to be built here and businesses to invest in. Are we just drinking our own Kool-Aid here at the moment?
You know, it's incredibly clear. It's the fastest growing and has been the fastest growing tech center in the United States. Because people forget today that 25 years ago, there was no tech in New York. People would ask me, why is DoubleClick in New York and why not in Boston? No one would say that today. So today, New York already employs as many people in tech as San Francisco. There is no doubt in my mind that when we're sitting here 10 years from now, New York will be a much bigger center of employment for tech and we'll start to have some of the very biggest companies out here. This is a place that has human talent. The top graduates from the entire Ivy League, MIT, everyone, where do they want to live? They want to live in New York City. And that's what drives our industry, and it will continue to drive the industry.
Sorry, Ed. I'm pretty sure there's still room for both of us. Kevin Ryan of Alicorp, absolutely wonderful to have you here on the show.
When Adobe released its Firefly image generating model last year, the company said the artificial intelligence model was trained mainly on Adobe stock images, its database of hundreds of millions of licensed images. But behind the scenes, Adobe was relying in part on AI generated content to train Firefly, including from those same AI rivals that we've been talking about for many months. Bloomberg's Rachel Metz broke that story with Brody Ford and joins us now. So let's focus very clearly on what the reporting unearthed here, what the new part is. And I think it's that we learned a lot more about how Firefly was trained, but it's different to what Adobe had originally told us.
Precisely. So Adobe has spoken a lot very publicly about how Firefly is really different from these rival image generators. And it turns out that it included a bunch of AI-generated images, some of which are from Midjourney, in the training of Firefly. And this was something I uncovered in my reporting. Brody and I worked together to pull this story together and found that the company had done this. I mean, it was clearly done on purpose. It is not a huge amount of its training data, but it's in there nonetheless.
What's important is, of course, that this was deemed the ethical version of AI, that you're paying for IP, and there's been some murkiness, to say the very least, in some of the other rival foundational models and generative models that we've seen. I'm interested as to what Adobe said in response, because I'm sure they're aware of some of these synthetic images that they were bringing in. Is there any risk of IP in this one?
Adobe was totally aware of what it was doing. I mean, we were looking at Discord groups that the company runs. It was talking, it had people from the company talking on Discord groups about including these images. They paid out a bonus in September to all the people whose images were used to train the first version of Firefly, and that included people such as one of my sources who is in the story, who only contributed AI-generated images to Adobe Stock, and most of those were Midjourney, made with Midjourney.
Fascinating as to therefore how far back that will go. Rachel Metz, it's a great story. Just so much coming out on Adobe at the moment. We appreciate her for it. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. What a wide-ranging set of conversations we've had, Ed.
Yeah, it's been a pretty intense week, news flow and markets-wise, and now earnings season comes and hits you in the face. What a lot of fun we still have to have. Recap the show. There was a lot of great Bloomberg reporting on Apple, on Adobe, as you just heard, and some pretty insightful interviews. Brett Winton from ARK in particular on that unusual investment in open AI, recap Apple, Spotify, iHeart, and we put the pod on the Bloomberg platforms. Happy Friday. This is Bloomberg Technology.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.